Previous shows, you can find them and transcripts on our site, fair.org. That's also the place to learn about our newsletter extra and to show much appreciated support for the show if you are able and so inclined. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio.
Could it be that Russia's war against Ukraine is driven by their nostalgia? And how often does nostalgia play a role in other wars? I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive. So much of human endeavor has been all about killing more people more quickly. Nations have spent more on the military budget, almost to the exclusion of every other investment which could actually bring better lives to a nation's inhabitants. Why? Think of all the past wars in the past 200 years. There are many official justifications for those wars. In World War II, Japan was open about their intent to control the Pacific. In the Spanish-American War, the U.S. expanded its empire. World War I was, of course, a family fight between ruling aristocracies, and basically no one won. America's war in Vietnam was all about stopping the spread of communism. Now we see a rather shocking display of mass murder of the civilians of Ukraine. Aside from the horror, what stands out about Russia's invasion is nostalgia. Nostalgia? Did I say nostalgia? Yes, more often than we would expect, wars are indeed launched from a place of nostalgia. We, at all times, we occasionally do feel nostalgic for a time past, so it's believed things were better back then. Life was simpler, and the challenges of today, of course, make us long for the good old days. The order of how it used to be was so familiar. Can't we just bring that back? When the word nostalgia first came into common use, it was understood to be a medical condition. Doctors inspecting it looked into the troublesome condition and saw that it was not based on reality, but some unidealized past memory made brighter and more beautiful through the lens of time. Fantasy of better days. In the American Civil War and World War I in particular, nostalgia was seen as unhealthy. The war was going on and was recognized to be the reality. Of course, individuals could miss their home and feel nostalgic, but it was isolated to those individuals, or so it was thought. But as we'll discuss today, individual nations are also greatly affected by nostalgia, and that can and does lead to terrible outcomes with the loss of massive numbers of lives, losses without any real gains. So how does nostalgia become policy? How does nostalgia fit with nationalism and imperialism? Well, our guest today, Dr. Lawrence Wittner, knows some answers to that, and we're going to look at that. It's very interesting and useful. Dr. Lawrence Wittner brings a unique and valuable insight into the surprising connection between nostalgia and a nation's belief that they have a right to make war. His article on the History News Network is titled "The Dangerous Trend of Imperial Nostalgia." It's not just Russia. Lawrence Wittner is professor of history emeritus at SUNY Albany and the author of Confronting the Bomb. Lawrence, Larry, thanks so much for being with us and keeping democracy alive.
Thank you, Bert. I'm delighted to be here today.
What does the war in Ukraine have to do with the human emotion, nostalgia? We'll look into that. Actually, perhaps it's all about a collective longing for past glory, real or more likely imagined. The greatness of the days of the Tsar and the might of the Soviet Union, that's what's at play in Ukraine. But as Wittner notes, it's not just Russia. Well, again, thanks for being with us, Larry. You write, although great empires rank among the most powerful engines of world history, they are also among the most dangerous, especially as they brood over their decline. Wow, there's been a lot of empires and declines through the many, many centuries. So what is this nostalgia in Russia today that is driving their war on Ukraine?
Well, I think we have to go back centuries. Russia began as a small territory, so-called Great Russia, and it expanded dramatically over the centuries. Tsarist Russia eventually became the largest nation on Earth, and it was composed of a vast mixture of subject peoples who were under the control of the Great Russians of this smaller principality, they were often dissatisfied. That is, the subject peoples were dissatisfied with this state of affairs, and they revolted at times. At times, other nations managed to pry off part of the Tsarist Imperium. But nonetheless, Russia was the largest nation in the world up to the time of the First World War. When the Bolshevik Revolution broke that up and transformed what Vladimir Lenin had called the prison of nations into a different sort of system. Lenin had believed that subject peoples should be freed from imperial domination, that Russia shouldn't operate this prison system of subject peoples, and he actually freed various nationality groups from Russian control. But for the most part, he substituted a system that would provide for nationality rights. So in Ukraine, for example, there would be a Ukrainian People's Republic, and there would be other republics, and these in turn would get together and they form the Soviet Union, a union of these separate republics, and there would be nationality rights. However, under Stalin, the nationality rights were gradually withdrawn, and things were tightened up, and the Soviet Union, in fact, not only clamped down on different nationality groups, including the Ukrainians who were starved during the 1930s, the early 30s, when there was near genocide. Call it fully genocide, but they were actually starved to death by their Moscow overlords. And in 1939, of course, the Nazi-Soviet Pact was signed, and this freed up Stalin for actually gobbling up additional places like Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia that had been freed by the Bolsheviks, as well as portions of Poland. And then, of course, at the end of the Second World War, even part of that time, of course, the Germans double-crossed their Russian allies, and they invaded the Soviet Union, and the Russians fought back alongside their newfound allies, the United States and Britain, and as victors in the war, took over large portions of Eastern Europe. So the Tsarist Empire was really succeeded by the Soviet Empire, the Russians controlled this vast empire that during the Cold War was, of course, pitted against the United States. So when the Russians look at Ukraine, they say, why should Ukraine be independent? How can it dare hook up with NATO? How can it hook up with the European Union? The Ukrainians are a part of Russia and always have been, although that's not true. Right. But nonetheless, they claim that. They look back to the glorious past mm-hmm. of the empire and of the Soviet Union.
And the damage that it's causing, just believing in that. It does appear that a major turning point in the longing for the old Soviet Union came in 1991. I mean, it is amazing to me how the feeling in Russia now in 2022 is, as you say, that we want it back, even though they didn't really have it. But in 1991, Russian leaders, as you say, were suddenly adrift. The Soviet Empire, as you mentioned, had been geographically huge, the biggest country in the world. So what happened in 1991 that befuddled them so much? And were there options that they didn't choose that might have been better?
Well, it's hard to say what would have been better, but nonetheless, what happened was that Gorbachev, as the president of the Soviet Union,
right.
At the time that there were pressures to give up the Soviet Empire, he agreed that the Ukrainians could have a vote on independence, a referendum, and this was freely held. The Russians backed off on it.
Mm.
They let the Ukrainians vote, and the result was that 92% of Ukrainians voted for independence. So Gorbachev said goodbye to them, and Ukraine was an independent nation from that point on. Gorbachev didn't want them to leave, but he recognized that they didn't want to stay. So the Soviet Union had come to a turning point in 1991. They had let the Estonians, the Latvians, the Lithuanians go. They let the Ukrainians go, and other groups chose independence at that point. And Russia could have continued on those lines. Could have said, "Well, these were groups that didn't want to be under Russian hegemony or united with Russia anymore." So we'll accept the fact that we're no longer a great empire. We consider ourselves a great nation, of course, but nonetheless, we can live and let live. But they chose in the end under Putin not to do that.
And between Gorbachev and Putin, there was Yeltsin. How did he approach the breakup as compared to Putin? Go ahead.
Yeah, he accepted it. You know, again, there was a longing for the glorious past when Russia was the greatest nation on the earth, when people trembled before the Soviet Union or looked to the Soviet Union as a great leader in world liberation. But nonetheless, he basically accepted this, and in fact, in the Budapest. Memorandum of 1994, when the Ukrainians got together with the Russians and the Americans and agreed on a future security arrangement for Ukraine, when Ukraine was turning over its nuclear weapons to Russia, which it did, the Russians agreed in this Budapest Memorandum of 1994 that it would respect Ukraine's territorial sovereignty and would not intervene in Ukrainian affairs.
Well, that changed, that's for sure. My goodness.
That's right. And gradually, there's been a backsliding on the Budapest Memorandum and an increasing demand under Putin's rule that Ukraine must never turn away from the Russians and can never do certain things. And therefore, when they do, the Russians have the right to take control of Ukraine once more.
They're finding out it's easier said than done, that's for
sure.
That's
right.
If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're talking about the dangerous trend of imperial nostalgia. And it's not just Russia. Our guest is the author of an article on that topic on history, the History News Network, Professor Lawrence Widner. And it's not just Russia, but Putin. Wow, interesting how what he does, with things people do for political power, it never ceases to amaze me. You write that as early as 2005, Putin told the Russian parliament that the collapse of the Soviet Empire was, quote, the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the century. He called it a genuine tragedy for the Russian people. Talk about the significance of this, please, and its context in 2005.
Well, as Putin gradually solidified his political power and his political control in Russia in the post-Soviet period, he began to speak up for traditional Russian nationalism and to look to the past for Russian glory. As I mentioned, he idealized Stalin, among others, because he recognized that Stalin hadn't let the Ukrainians have their way in the Soviet Union, but had clamped down on them, and he was going to restore Russia's past glory, or what he felt was Russia's past glory. Now, he was also, by the way, under pressure from Russian nationalists that were very disappointed with Russia's reduced status in the post-Soviet period. And he in a way headed them off or absorbed their constituency. They liked what Putin started to say. So Putin viewed this as not only something justified by Russian history, but also something that was politically useful to him, just as of course Donald Trump views talk about making America great again as useful politically for him. More recently, Putin has actually come out with statements which have been published and publicized by his regime, in which he said that Ukraine was never an independent nation. It was always Russian. It's Russian land.
Right, right.
And of course, Russia has the right to control it. When Ukraine talked about joining the European Union or making some sort of deal with them, back almost a decade ago, it should not have been allowed to do this. Their natural home was Russia. The Russians and the Ukrainians were brothers and
right.
sisters,
right.
Of course, to be dominated by the Russian side of the relationship. And therefore, Ukraine really lacked the right of being an independent nation.
Boy, it sure is interesting when the world is looked at through nostalgia-colored glasses.
Right.
It's just not real. So The Russian military, I have to believe, has some significant political power, as the military in pretty much every nation does. What were some of the first signs of the implementation of imperial nostalgia by the Russian military?
Well, of course, the military missed the fact that they had been reduced in size thanks to the breakup of the old Soviet Union, that Russia had much less money. It was undergoing economic crises, and the regime could hardly maintain the old Soviet military power. So generals found they were being reduced or retired, and the armed forces didn't get all the military gadgets they wanted. There were arms control and disarmament treaties signed with the United States, in which both sides reduced their numbers of nuclear weapons, and the military didn't like this.
Of course.
And when Putin started to use them once more for military purposes rather than just sit at home and practice waging war, they were pleased by this. And so, for example, they were used to move into the independent nation of Georgia, one of these subject groups that had been freed when the Soviet Union collapsed. They were used to win the civil war in Syria for the Assad regime. Russia moved in with a massive bombing campaign to destroy the rebellion against Assad's rule and help to win the war for Assad. They were used later, 2014, to move into Crimea. And to simply annex it for Russian territory. Crimea was, of course, part of Ukraine, but it was just taken back by Russia through its military power. And they were also used to instigate a separatist revolt in the Donbass region, the easternmost sliver of Ukraine. And this separatist revolt, I mean, there were people of Russian background,
right,
easternmost region, but they would certainly have not been capable of staging a full-scale military revolt with anti-aircraft guns and tanks and missiles and so on without the Russian military moving in and arming them and actually fighting for them. So the revolt there that has gone on ever since that time, right up to the present, was backed by the Russian military. So, the military was now fulfilling what it viewed as its function once more, and that was winning war for the great Russia of the past.
Glory restored. Ah, must feel
right.
Great. But as your article is titled, "The Dangerous Trend of Imperial Nostalgia," it's not just Russia. As we look in the past to see the role of nostalgia in various different wars that have taken millions of lives. Back in the First World War, regular listeners knew I'd bring that up, one of the imperial belligerents was formerly Great Britain. And I mean that quite clearly. The greatness was based upon the sun never setting on the British Empire. Well, it did set. It did, in fact, set. And you write that disconsolate Russian officials have their counterparts in Britain. So fast forward to the 21st century, and we have the ever-tousled Prime Minister Boris Johnson, of formerly Great Britain, whom you quote from 2002. This is interesting to me. "The problem is not that we were once in charge, but that we are not in charge anymore," end of quote. What are some of the post-World War II examples of British examples of British imperialism being led by nostalgia?
Yes, well, Britain, of course, had been the great overseas colonizer of the 19th and 20th centuries. It ruled perhaps one-fourth of the globe. So when the Britons sang "Rule Britannia," it really did rule the world.
Yes.
Of course, other imperial powers didn't like this, and they were at odds with Britain, such as Germany. But in the post-war period, Britain faced the fact that it had come down in economic power. It was devastated by the Second World War, much reduced in terms of the relative size of its armed forces as compared to the United States and to the Soviet Union. So Britain simply didn't have the economic and military power to hold on to its colonies that were busy rebelling against British colonial rule. It was a good time, after all, to free themselves. Britain was on its imperial last legs, it seemed. Here was the chance to break loose, and many of them did. But Britain sought to hold on to what it could. So in Africa, for example, in Kenya, the British waged a brutal war against the Mau Mau, who were seeking independence through a revolution, and British mass murder of a good portion of the population took place during the 1950s. One of the most brutal anti-colonial military occupations in world history. Better known is the Suez invasion of 1956. The British, along with their imperial allies, the French, as well as the Israelis, who were all very distressed with the government of Nasser in Egypt, who was leading in the Third World and calling for Third World independence and even a rebellion against imperial rule. Nasser, who had seized the Suez Canal from its British control of the past. Suez, the lifeline to India and to Asia and so on for many years for the British Empire. Well, the British were just horrified by this, and so they got together with these other powers, as I mentioned, and they just invaded Suez and seized the Suez Canal. They were not going to allow these upstart Egyptians to take control of Egyptian territory. So, but in this case, imperialism didn't work. This vain attempt to hold on to imperial power, and the United States turned against them, and the Soviet Union turned against them, and so the British, humiliated, had to withdraw from Suez. So they were very upset by this, but ultimately were forced to settle for a junior partnership with the United States. That is, they could still do something as a major power, but they recognized they needed the United States.
It is so interesting to me, the nostalgia mixed with humiliation and the fear of humiliation, the power of that fear. And Britain has, let's face it, been humiliated lots of times because of their own policy. The people that you know, there's a lot of deaths involved here. And it's just the role of nostalgia in making these policies. Just we need to understand that and hopefully do something about it. I don't know. There, another one of the world's great imperial powers was France. They didn't want to be outdone by their British rivals, unlike their island nation counterparts, I will say. At least the French culture can boast of its cuisine, unlike the UK. How they ever thought they could rule the world with that stuff, I have no idea. But seriously, how did French imperialism in Africa and Asia play into the nostalgia for French identity and pride? How did that impact the people of their former colonies?
Yes. Well, if Britain was the number one colonizer, then France was the number two, certainly in the modern world. At times, the British and the French were rivals, but they gradually drew together against other rivals, such as Germany, for example. In the post-Second World War period, the French faced the same problem that the British did. That is, they had been brought low by the Second World War. France had actually been conquered, of course, by the Germans, were driven out of their former imperial holdings. So many colonized peoples used that opportunity in the aftermath of the war, even during the war, to try to take control of their own countries and to see to it that the French didn't come back to rule them once more. And of course, the French faced the immediate problem in Vietnam.
Yes.
At the end of the Second World War. The Viet Minh, led by Ho Chi Minh, had fought first against the collaborationist French rule, the Vichy French, the ones who were who had aligned themselves with Germany, with the German conquerors, and then when the Japanese moved in and simply pushed the collaborationist French to the side, they fought against the Japanese. And at the end of the war, as the Japanese were defeated, the Viet Minh moved into throughout Vietnam.
Oh, yeah.
And they declared their independence in from the French. And therefore, the Viet Minh ruled Vietnam. But, of course, the French weren't going to let that happen. Mm. And so they moved back in, first promising the Viet Minh various things, and then eventually turning on them and waging a war for the recolonization of Vietnam. Of course, eventually they were defeated there. One more humiliation for the colonizers, 1954. So they signed an agreement with the Viet Minh. But they still had a foothold in other places, such as Algeria.
Oh, yeah.
Indeed, they claimed that Algeria was part of metropolitan France. Mm. Algeria was actually not just a colony, but Algeria was French. And the great nationalist colonialist cry was Algérie française. It wasn't just a colony. Algeria, like Ukraine, was part of the great motherland, so on. So, of course, they weren't planning to let Algeria go, and they fought a bitter counterinsurgency war there in the post-war years, including torture and mass killing and so on in Algeria. The Algerians, though, fought on.
Yes.
And the French military, which was now headquartered to a large degree in Algeria to suppress the insurgency, the French military leaders feared that the French government back home was going to finally sign a treaty with the Algerians and give them their freedom. So the French military revolted, and they landed paratroopers in Paris. That is, the military went back, and they staged a military coup in France, seizing power and deposing the civilian government of the elected government of France. They deposed the French Republic, and for a time the military was in charge.
Oh,
and then they handed things over to a man, thanks to his Second World War glory, Charles de Gaulle,
mm-hmm.
that they thought would be a reliable spokesman for continuing continued French rule in Algeria. But over the years, as the Algerians continued their war and France was simply not able to suppress the revolt, de Gaulle began negotiations with the Algerians for a peace treaty. Well, this enraged, of course, the French military, which again rose up and sought to depose de Gaulle. But de Gaulle was an old hand at exercising power,
yes.
And he also had some supporters inside the French military. So he managed to outmaneuver the French generals and to stay in power and to suppress the revolt. Although for years in France, there were bombs being set off by these irreconcilable colonialists who demanded that Algeria remain French. But ultimately, they were suppressed. And I should add, the chunk of the French population that looked back to Algérie Française and looked back to French to France's colonial glory rallied around a new party, the National Front,
uh-huh.
An extreme right-wing colonialist party that was led by the father of Marine Le Pen, the French nationalist leader today, who has mm-hmm. renamed the party the National Rally, and of course nearly won the French presidency on the basis of this hyper-nationalism and support for France's former glory. So, imperial nostalgia is not dead in France even today.
Boy, that is for sure. 42% she got. Imperial
right.
nostalgia. Ah, the image of the glory days. People sing about that. And back to Vietnam. After World War II, the Viet Minh believed what the United States had said at its foundation, that our mission is to help nations formerly imprisoned by imperialist forces and to support their liberation. Ho Chi Minh flew an American flag early on. I think it was in 1945. Then came the Red Scare in the 50s in America. The imagined frame around the reality of Vietnam, was that it was just part of what was called the Soviet bloc. It was, as with the independence movements in the former British and French colonies, as you write, fears arose among Americans that they were losing nations around the world to communists, revolutionaries, and nationalists. And I'm reminded, I don't know who said it, but back in the 50s, during the McCarthy era, there was the question that haunted the country, who lost China? As if we owned China. how did this deep fear of losing the image, which was stamped onto America by the McCarthy era, play into what President Johnson said about why we would not allow ourselves to be defeated by Vietnam? How was that? How does nostalgia? What's the role of nostalgia in that?
Yes, well, the United States has an interesting history when it comes to colonialism.
Yep.
On the one hand, of course, it began as a small sliver of British colonies that broke free from colonial rule. So in that sense, it was an anti-colonial force. But the reality also was that it expanded from that small sliver
right.
of colonies across the vast continent of North America, and then into the Caribbean, and then became a great power around the world. So, on the one hand, it could help the Viet Minh in its struggle against the Japanese during the Second World War, and the Viet Minh, indeed, when they set up Vietnam, used the U.S. Declaration of Independence as a model, and it begins, all men are created equal, and so on. So it actually models itself on the United States, or at least the United States as an anti-colonial power.
Yes.
But as we've seen, the reality was that although the United States didn't always call it colonialism, or sometimes it did, for example, during the Philippine War, the fact was that the United States had been an expansionist power on the world scene, and it had interests and it had control in many places, as in China. And therefore, it wasn't so hard to say that the United States had lost China. And who had lost China? Well, obviously, traitors at home, because the United States should never have lost it in the first place. And similarly, with other charges against the United States. Now, this was useful politically for the Republican Party. Certainly, they charged, in fact, that the Democratic Party was the party of 20 years of treason, right? It sold out to the communist menace and so on, and that it started when the United States recognized the Soviet Union back in 1933, but it continued as the Soviet Union gobbled up Eastern Europe and China. Supposedly the Soviets had gobbled up China. That wasn't true. Chinese gobbled up China. But the fact was that it was a very useful political ploy to claim that the United States was losing the world. But nonetheless, many other people, aside from the Republicans, had this dreamy vision of the United States as the greatest nation in the history of the world, as they like to say. And therefore, if it was the greatest nation in the history of the world, it deserved to rule the world, right? Or at least have something to say about every rebellion and every government around the world, rather than just to think, horror of horrors, that the United States was just one of many nations. And it should respect their national rights just as they should respect U.S. national rights. So, of course, this imperialist nostalgia was very great in the United States and went beyond just Republicans. So it was easy for Johnson to say, how dare this little Vietnamese nation stand up against the great United States, and so on. Who were they to tell the United States who should rule Vietnam, right?
There's no racism involved here, of course. No, not at all. And that makes me think of another nostalgia that there is in the United States. In the 1860s, there was this rebellion, this move for a secession to become an independent nation by the South. We know it as the Civil War, and the effects are still there. There's this emotional clinging to the lost cause, the idealized way of life that the South lost in the Civil War. And I wonder, fast forward to current news, could nostalgia for an idealized white Protestant male rule be fueling terrible racist bloodshed across America? Is nostalgia a part of that? I suspect that it is.
Oh, I'm sure it is. And, certainly this replacement theory nonsense and so on.
Yeah.
Shows the racist roots of this sort of thing. But also keep it in mind, thanks to the U.S. Global imperial role, if I can use that term.
Yes.
Americans have identified with that role, and therefore with the glorious wars that the U.S. fought in the past, and the military and the armed forces and the use of the gun and the weapon are linked to this past glory.
Yeah.
That is, the military probably has the highest rating in prestige of major institutions in the United States, right?
I
think polls tend to show that, right? The military is one institution of the U.S. government that people really admire and so on. Our heroes, right? Similarly, the use of guns in the United States and of gun culture is to some degree based on the glory of past wars, right? And people identifying with the heroic role that U.S. troops have played in the past. So you combine that with racism, and you have a powerful incentive for young men to arm themselves, right? And mm-hmm. and stand up there and show that they're real men, and being a mm-hmm. real man means you carry a gun and you don't let anyone stand in the way of the greatness of the U.S. past. And of course the greatness supposedly was based on a white American, often white Protestant American vision of the past.
I have to think that some of the motivation for January 6th, 2021 was that similar nostalgia for the greatness of America, and nobody was going to get in their way. They felt like they were doing a good thing, which of course brings up, as we mentioned a little while ago, about the current manifestation of nostalgia is Donald Trump's Make America Great Again. What a great phrase. And one thing I know from politics, you got to keep it simple and people can identify. Part of the magic appeal of that phrase is that everyone can plug in their own version of what that means. Make America great again. Oh, isn't that nice? The power of those simplistic words has been quite impressive and has led to terrible violence and hatred in our streets. But as you point out, in reality, Make America Great Again is nothing new. I thought I'd heard it before, but I wasn't sure. And thanks to your essay, we see this brazen policy making by nostalgia did not originate with the former guy, the orange one. Do tell.
Well, you know, certainly that's been a theme throughout U.S. history. That is the reverence for the flag, the Pledge of Allegiance, a whole range of other things that are misty-eyed nationalist calls to identify with American greatness. And in fact, other politicians have played on that theme. And even the phrase "Make America Great Again" was used in speeches by Ronald Reagan, for example, and also used in speeches by Bill Clinton. So not just a monopoly of Republicans. although I think in the case of Donald Trump, he was specifically latching on to it because at times Barack Obama, who is of course a symbol of the decline of white supremacy, right? Mm-hmm. Why should a man like this be president of the United States, a person of color? You know, right. That was already a decline. But occasionally Obama would say things like, well, other, you know, other countries have their traditions too, and we should respect them and respect the United Nations and so on. And that was red meat for the right wing in this country. They could come roaring back with Donald Trump saying, America is not just another nation, it's the greatest nation in the history of the world, and we're going to see to it that we're going to make America great again. Uh-huh. And those Democrats are the party once more of treason to the United States and to its glory. They're ruining the United States, but we're going to bring us back to greatness again. So I think it's wrapped up in several traditional packages here.
The greatness, the glory days of the past. We're talking on Keeping Democracy Alive with Professor Lawrence Wittner, who's written an article on the History News Network, which I highly recommend, titled "The Dangerous Trend of Imperial Nostalgia." And it's not just Russia. We're talking about a bunch of nations. And currently, one of the new sort of big boys on the block is China. Greatness and humiliation are both part of their history. You know, China's leaders, especially Xi Jinping, have reached deeper into the past to locate its era of imperial glory. So tell us, please, about Xi's use of imperial nostalgia and how it seems to be playing into the current wolf warrior diplomacy? What does that mean? What is he up to?
Okay, well, of course, China was a great imperial empire centuries back, and ruled a good chunk of Southeast Asia. But, of course, in more recent centuries, particularly during the 19th and 20th century, European colonial powers were on the move, and they began to carve up China to resist its barriers to things like opium, for example. China tried to restrict the opium trade to the Chinese government tried to restrict the opium trade coming to China from Great Britain, but of course Britain felt it had a perfect right to rule the waves and to bring opium in.
Oh yeah,
profitable. So it did so, and it defeated China in the so-called Opium War. And from that point on, China's defenses were down, and various Western treaty ports were set up within China, with China having no control of what was done there. These became sort of foreign entrepôts where the Chinese government had no ability to control what went on. And missionary activities took place, mm-hmm. and various territories were taken out of China's hands by the British, by the French, by the Germans, by the United States, and most recently by the Japanese, who moved in during the 1930s and began to take over large portions of China. Their rallying cry was Asia for the Asiatics, but of course this really meant for the Japanese. So they were driving out the British and the French and so on, but they were taking over China for themselves, and the Chinese recognized this. So the Chinese were very humiliated by this colonialism at their expense. So after the Second World War and after the success of the Communist Revolution in China, Mao Zedong's new communist regime on the mainland sought to build up China as a great power, and he wasn't very good at it, as it turned out, but economically at least. But nonetheless, his more recent successors have been, and so China has emerged as a major economic power, and as it has done that, it has also built up its military forces.
Yes.
So today, China is not only the second largest economic power in the world, second to the United States, mm-hmm. but the second largest military power to the United States in terms of military spending. So China is in many ways a rival to the United States,
sure.
and to other former imperial powers, looking back on their past glory. Mm-hmm. And Xi has characterized this as the restoration of China's greatness, and rather than settle as Japan has settled since the Second World War for the restoration of its economic power, but not its vast military power or its imperial role in the war in the world, Xi has begun to use the military to extend China's control of various places, so that, for example, there are islands in mm-hmm. the South China Sea that it has seized, that it has set up military fortifications on. Other nations claim these islands. Vietnam claims some of them. The Philippines claims some of them. Other nations claim some of them. But nonetheless, here are Chinese fortifications and military and air vessels there.
Mm.
So, and there are conflicts over Taiwan.
Yes,
China had stated that it would respect Taiwan's not not independent, since it claimed Taiwan was a traditionally part of China. But it said, well, we're not going to invade, and gradually the people on Taiwan will see that their best opportunity for the future is to reunify themselves with China. Well, of course, that hasn't happened.
No.
So Xi is now talking about he's making a claim that Taiwan should not go too far, or China, might have to move in. And now there are Chinese military flights over Taiwan.
And you can ask, I just wanted to, sorry to interrupt, but the people of Hong Kong, China is going for its glory days once again. And it amazed me. And there's not a lot of time left here for us to talk about, but it's not just the big nations that do it. As you point out, Turkey, India, Hungary, Austria, and other nations. I mean, the Ottoman Empire, it's been gone for a long time, but they're still playing a role in the 2020s.
Right. Well, I guess all these nations have this revival, usually on the political right wing, of nostalgia for their glorious past. Israel's a particularly glaring example of this, though, in that its claim in the region, in the Middle East, it's based on the Bible and a very ancient rule there, right?
Yeah.
But of course, the Jewish population in the last century was not very, very great there till the large numbers of Jews migrated from Europe and from the other portions of the Middle East, so that the current Israeli government maintains this right to the West Bank based on the glorious past and so on.
The glorious past. Well, before we go too far, solutions. You write, as we cope with a planet riven by international conflict and war, let us consider how dreams of imperial grandeur might be discarded, and how a strengthened United Nations might be used to fashion a more secure and cooperative world. I mean, even our current president talks about America as the world's indispensable nation. The revitalized militaristic nationalist right has long opposed any international war preventive body like the League of Nations or the United Nations. But they are not the only voice. The military might now be a unique moment for reflection and reconsideration of our dreams of imperial grandeur. Any signs of hope for this?
Well, I think there are. The United Nations developed out of the Second World War, this horrible, worst international catastrophe in the world up to that time, and since then, too. So an international security system was set up under the United Nations to be maintained by the UN Security Council. But the imperial powers, the great powers that had come out of the Second World War, didn't want the United Nations to interfere with their policies.
Mm-hmm.
That is, the Russians didn't mind the UN interfering with U.S. policies, but they didn't want interfering with their policies. So they would veto things in the Security Council, and vice versa. The U.S. would veto things when things would go against the United States and so on. So the Security Council became something of a joke. That is, it could, great powers could speak there, but the implementation of this international security system was blocked. So to go back to the present, the Ukraine war is just one more sign that the world desperately needs an effective international security system, as has been talked of, but has not been implemented. That fact, plus the climate crisis and the disease crisis around the world, plus other things going on, offer us the opportunity to do some new thinking about how to cast aside nationalism and dreams of imperial grandeur, and to actually go beyond that old stuff and to strengthen the United Nations as the real voice for the people of the world and as an effective player in realizing the interests and the goals of the people of the world. So I think the United Nations, if strengthened, if the veto is weakened or abolished, if the UN gets taxing power, for example, to raise funding for world health and for eradication of poverty, for example, and a whole range of other things the UN could be doing and I think should be doing, and indeed were being talked of at the time it was set up, then I think we're talking about a new and better world.
And we can't give up. I mean, we can give up, but we should not give up. We are not powerless. The powers that be want us to believe we are powerless, but we are not. Very interesting discussion and some degree of hope there. Our guest has been Lawrence Wittner, Professor of History Emeritus at SUNY Albany, and he's written about the dangerous trend of imperial nostalgia. Let's try to get in the moment rather than be led by nostalgia. Do you think? Maybe. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Bert.
If you enjoyed that discussion, don't miss a single show. Subscribe. It's all free. iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and of course the website, keepingdemocracylive.com. Thank you.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.